Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, providing information on a $350,000 donation from the KGH Auxiliary to Kingston Health Sciences Centers.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
The Kingston General Hospital Auxiliary has made a significant investment in local healthcare, presenting Kingston Health Sciences Centers with $314,650 at their 120th annual general meeting last week. President of the Auxiliary, Chelsea Reynolds, spoke with CFRC about the accomplishment after difficult years during and following the pandemic.
So leading into COVID, we had been in the middle of a seven-year commitment, and we had pledged $2.5 million. And so it was a little bit of a struggle in 2020, 21, 22 to meet that commitment because things hadn't been, you know, we'd shut down, the cafe was a little bit limited, and so it was hard. And now, yeah, we've ramped right back up and we're back to where we had been pre-COVID. So it's very exciting.
Between the consistent effort, generous donors, and other programs returning, all efforts came together to bring the total back to pre-COVID numbers.
We've been able to open back up our lottery booth. It had closed for COVID, and then we opened again in the fall of 23. So that has helped. And the cafe has just been a very steady growth again. And we always like to say, like, we really rely on our staff there, and shout out to our manager in particular, who's done a really good job. She's always looking for, you know, fresh and local and, you know, suppliers that she can work with on what we need throughout the year. So that has helped. And our staff, like not our staff, but the staff in the hospital are extremely loyal. Like we have people that line up, you know, they know the specials that are coming up and, you know, they commit to getting their lunches there. So that's fantastic. So yeah, it's just been sort of a, you know, a whole bunch of different things that have, you know, just built back up.
The Auxiliary chose to commit to a selection of items to make an immediate impact, a slight shift after their previous commitment towards redevelopment at the hospital.
So last year, I think we gave, I think it was $250,000. And so then this year we were able to up it a little bit. But that money went towards redevelopment, which was what that seven-year commitment had been. And now redevelopment is on hold on the hospital's end. And so as a group, we decided we wanted to do something that would be a little more immediate, a little more in action right away kind of thing. So that's why we've gone with the $314,000. We're doing NICU ventilators, and we're doing the oncology treatment chairs. And those are things that can be purchased in the short term and, you know, be used right away in the hospital. So
the total allowed them to make significant headway, exceeding expectations.
Like the oncology chairs, there was supposed to be a three-year commitment. They were hoping to get five every year, and we had enough money that we could do all 15. So we can just tick that one off the list, and we'll see what comes up next year.
In all, the funds will be used to purchase a point-of-care ultrasound machine for the pediatric program, four NICU ventilators, and 15 oncology treatment chairs. In addition, the KGH Auxiliary is also providing educational funding for KHSC staff through the annual Millennium Bursary Fund, as well as supporting elder life and critical care programs. The group came together at their annual general meeting last week to announce the total and celebrate.
This is our best turnout at our AGM since before COVID as well, because I think everybody was excited to see that amount and to, you know, do you feel like you're part of the group that's working towards something together? And, you know, like I do with the lottery booth, and you think, oh, well, you know, it's just a couple hours, a couple times a week, but like every little bit counts and you're contributing. And so, yeah, everybody has been really excited. And I know Dr. Pecora and the staff at the hospital had also come to the meeting and, you know, offered lots of appreciation to our volunteers.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about Napanee Council's approval of a proposed Veterans Memorial Crosswalk.
Thank you, Jesse. The Town Council of Greater Napanee heard a deputation from Tiffany Lloyd of Greater Napanee Connect at their regular meeting on Tuesday, July 8th, requesting a Veterans Memorial Crosswalk. After reviewing the design and plans, the council approved the new crosswalk in principle, with an official vote scheduled to the next council meeting on Tuesday, July 22nd. Lloyd kept her presentation short because the crosswalk had been discussed at council a number of times. A fire truck pull to raise the funds for the crosswalk received council's approval and took place in the spring. Lloyd asked that the Veterans Memorial Crosswalk be placed at the bottom of John Street, directly in front of the Legion. She explained that the Napanee Legion branch had approved the design and the location. It features bold red and white stripes, a soldier silhouette, and the words, "Lest We Forget." The idea for a Veterans Memorial Crosswalk arose in response to negative social media posts that criticized the installation of a Pride crosswalk in the town 4 years ago. Greater Napanee Pride initiated the crosswalk, and member Brad Ray began a social media campaign to raise funds for the Rainbow Crosswalk in 2021. Greater Napanee Pride has since done yearly fundraising for the upkeep and replacement of the crosswalk. Some negative social media comments suggested that the town should install a crosswalk for veterans rather than a Pride-themed crosswalk, despite the fact that no public funds were allocated for the Pride-themed crosswalk project. Lloyd, the vice president of Greater Napanee Pride, decided to spearhead this campaign. Lloyd noted that these crosswalks aren't meant to be political statements, but rather a way to build a more connected and compassionate Greater Napanee. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forestell for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LGI reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the Township of Leeds and Thousand Islands Council's choice to defer a decision on how to standardize services and equipment at its community halls.
Thank you, Dinah. The Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands has deferred a decision on how to standardize services and equipment at its community halls following mixed opinions and a call for more information during last Monday's Committee of the Whole meeting. Council was presented with several options for harmonizing amenities across three township-owned rental facilities, the Seelies Bay Hall, Lansdowne Meeting Room, and Lansdowne Community Hall, which currently offer inconsistent levels of kitchen equipment, dishware, and public access. The discussion focused on health and safety standards, operational costs, and the future role of these community buildings. Deputy Mayor Terry Fody called the halls, quote, the heartbeats of the community, and emphasized that public health standards must take priority if they are to remain open and functional. Several costed options were presented, ranging from maintaining the current state with equipment replacements to introducing a full-service model with all new dishware and kitchen amenities. Estimates for implementation range from $10,000 to $185,000. Staff reported that current revenues from the three rental halls total just over $25,000 annually, meaning some options could take years to recoup costs. One possible funding avenue may be the town's Special Projects Reserve Fund, which is being bolstered as the municipality moves away from relying on casino revenue. No final decision was made, with council expected to revisit the discussion at its next meeting.
Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to the LGAI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about public concerns over a proposed subdivision in Bath.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. At a public meeting this week, residents of Amherst View voiced concerns about the Windsor Retirement Residence now also housing an alternative health facility. The Windsor currently does not have the zoning they need to house the facility. The proposed zoning bylaw amendment would allow the Windsor to provide temporary living accommodation and medical care, something they've already begun doing. This type of situation is normally following transfer from local hospitals and would last until the patient's well-being can support a return to their own residence. Resident of Park Crescent, Will Hume, brought up his concerns and spoke about a petition that residents have signed.
That is not what our neighborhood was designed for, and it is not what we were promised when this development was approved. This concern is not mine alone. 23 residents of Park Crescent, the strong majority of our street, have signed a petition opposing the zoning amendment. We are not opposed to seniors housing or healthcare services. We are opposed to our neighborhood being redefined around the needs of a private operator rather than the needs of the people who live here.
Resident of Park Crescent, Steve Peterson, spoke about the changes he's noticed.
When the Windsor was first opened, it was a retirement residence, which led some, mostly myself, to believe it would be quiet. I've recently been informed now that they want to change in the retirement residence to a rehab center, which is not what the property was originally zoned for and the residents agreed to.
Resident of Park Crescent, Alex Robinson, noted his family's experience since moving in.
Like our fellow residents, we've seen quite a change from when we moved in 2018 to now. When we moved in, it was a quiet retirement home that was quite nice and peaceful to live to. But we've seen quite a change since the transitional care unit has moved in.
Hume spoke about the Sunrite Group, the corporation that owns the Windsor.
The Sunrite Group is primarily a hotel chain, not a healthcare provider. Their business model emphasizes high occupancy and rapid turnover, and their ongoing expansion into residential and healthcare adjacent spaces raises concerns about how far this model may spread and who will have oversight when it does.
Hume went on to speak about voicing his concerns to Sunrite and noted their response to concerns about parking on Park Crescent.
Earlier this year, I had the opportunity to speak with the vice president of operations at the Sunrite Group, and while I appreciated the chance to raise my concerns, I was struck by the gap between managing a property and living next to it. When I brought up the issue of traffic, I was told by him that it had already been solved and that they, meaning the company, might consider more parking restrictions if the bylaw was approved. And sure enough, last month, new parking restrictions were imposed on our side of the street where residents live, while on the other side, used primarily by staff and visitors for parking, remains untouched.
Peterson spoke about the parking issues he's noticed.
As a resident on the same street of a school, we've been mindful not to park on the street during the hours of 9 and 3, as school buses can't fit down the road at the same time. In 2025, they introduced no parking on my side of the road at all hours, including summer holidays, meaning myself or my family members have no place to park because the Windsor staff take up all the street parking. It's caused parking problems for residents and traffic congestion for everyone who travels up and down the street. As a resident on the street, I'm disappointed in the decisions the township has made so far, putting large business ahead of its residents.
Resident of Amherstview, Wayne Pryor, spoke about the parking concerns as well as emergency services.
I'm definitely pro-health care. The only thing is the situation with the parking on Park Street is horrendous. It's just horrible. One of the recycle trucks went down through, and I was two cars behind them, I had to follow them every stop. What happens if a fire truck had come down there? Because he had nowhere to go. I mean, if you want to pull in quick or somebody, you get a delivery or something like that, no parking, no stopping or whatever. So, you know, just to me, it's ridiculous.
Hume spoke about how the company's model doesn't fit their neighborhood.
This is not equitable planning. It is reactive accommodation for a growing business that our street was never meant to absorb. On top of that, the proposal seeks to reduce aisle widths, shrink parking spaces, and remove planting strip requirements, all to make room for more vehicles and higher turnover. These kinds of concessions might work in a hotel parking lot, but in a residential neighborhood, they create tighter, more dangerous spaces for drivers, pedestrians, and emergency vehicles alike.
Planning supervisor with the township, James Griffin, noted what passing the amendment would do for the facility.
In terms of the use, the proposed alternative health facility use is not permitted. It has come to staff's attention that the site is being used for that use, and that is why the zoning amendment has been submitted in order to rectify that. If it isn't passed, then the use would have to stop.
Griffin said they'll have a recommendation for council soon.
We've written down all the comments, and we'll be coming forward in the future with a recommendation report to council.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about Nash's Home Hardware in Wellington, Prince Edward County.
Walking around the Home Hardware store in Wellington, Prince Edward County, was like walking into a bygone era, starting with the sleigh bells announcing my entry, to the creaking floors, and of course the sound of the old cash register. Five generations of the Nash family have supplied the region with hardware since 1905, and the remaining three generations recently celebrated 120 years in business. Here are some of the highlights from my conversation with current owner Evan Nash and his father Ted about the past and the future of the hardware business. Do you have any idea what the population was in 1905? In Wellington?
I think the population of Wellington was 1,000 to 1,200 or something back in those days. But it was a happening place, too. It would have been seasonally, would have expanded. Like, you know, when the factories were running, everybody came from the north. They picked, they worked in the factories, they did every job.
You know, in 1905, for a building the size of our building to have been built was a pretty ambitious project, and it's a pretty interesting project in that it was a relatively contemporary way of building and creating retail space to put it in what is essentially a strip mall, right? And Fitzgerald, the building's called the Fitzgerald mm-hmm. Block after, I think it's Willard, but a super interesting architect and builder from the turn of the century in Wellington, and he's responsible for an immense number of buildings in Wellington, and also this commercial block, which was one of his crown jewels. And he did a lot of interesting, he did prefabbed housing, he mixed styles, he did adaptive reuse, so he did all this stuff that we're finding interesting, you know, as sort of contemporary architecture and building practices now, this guy was doing 120 years ago. So I mean, the building itself even tells you how interesting a place Wellington would have been in the summer back then.
What I found interesting was there were two hardware stores in Wellington at one time.
Yeah, and I mean, there was two hardware stores and a lumber yard for a while.
So yeah. Did they all have something a little bit different?
A little different. And so there was Ed Ross, and they did farm supplies a bit more.
Okay, originally they bought that building. They bought that building from a guy named Bill Davern, and he was a World War I veteran, and he had operated a farm implement / hardware store type place. And Ed and his dad bought that out and joined the Home Hardware Network in 1962 when they were, I believe it was 62, when Home Hardware came into being. Funny enough, when we bought that store out in 1988, they still had stuff in the store that was from Davern's hardware back, like spark plugs for a 1912 Massey Harrison, you know, sure. Crazy stuff like that, plow shears and things, guy. But yeah, two stores operate in Wellington, and that tells you something about how busy it was. I remember as a kid, I couldn't get home from school. I had to stop at the store, and we were threading pipe, and all the canning factories and stuff were operating. All the farmers had pipelines in their barns and stuff, and so I was cutting and threading pipe. There was no end to it. We also, our store originally was a tin shop. So think about everything you have in your house today that's made of plastic was made of tin. So every bucket, every pail, every bathtub, every furnace, every, you know, everything that was made out of
watering can, box, tote box, storage box.
Yeah, they made everything from tin.
And then stovepipe.
Yeah, so there was guys working in the back room banging stuff out of tin all day long with the smudges going. It was the soot on the ceiling was just as black as could be. And that's how I grew up. You know, doing all that kind of stuff. And we made stovepipes until, well, just a few years ago, we couldn't buy the metal anymore to make them. It wasn't worth it.
It's funny, too, when you say that Ed had stuff that was from Davern. So, you know, he ran that place for 20 years and still had merch. Like, I feel like I still have merch from 50 years ago that's in the store. So, like, somebody would come in and say, hey, I need a replacement pump leather for a hand pump water pump from 1942 and blah blah blah, and I'd look at them and be like, dude, like, they haven't manufactured those in 60 years, there's no, and dad would holler from the back and be like, yeah, I got them, do you want a left-handed or a right-handed, because he's got them, and they're buried in a little box down underneath a, you know, shoved underneath a shelf somewhere. And then it occurred to me, like, that's the magic of the small town hardware store, is that, yeah, not only do we have it, but somebody knows what you're talking about, knows how to use it, knows how to help you fix it, and actually has one on hand and can help you with the whole thing, which is just shocking. So I learned to bite my tongue. Yeah, and we were very happy to see it go. Absolutely.
Evan is the fifth generation and current owner of the store. He tells us how he joined the business.
The story goes, actually, I was living in Korea, and I was teaching English, and I was sitting in a Canadian bar in the sort of international portion of Korea, and I met a guy who knew our store because he had worked with Scotiabank. And so he said, I've been to Wellington. I've been to the Scotiabank. He was from Ottawa or something, but he was in this Canadian bar. And he's like, I know your dad. Like, I'm sure I've met him. I've been in your store a bunch of times. Every time I go to that bank, I would go to your hardware store. He said, what are you even doing here? Go home and run that business.
And that's exactly what you did.
Yeah.
And the Nash has moved to appliances a number of years ago.
Yeah, we started in the mid-80s. And I can remember when I sold the first fridge. But I remember selling that first fridge. And then he said, okay, when can you bring it? And it dawned on me, I have to deliver this. That's a good question. But that's where it all started, back in the mid-80s. There was a few people around, but nobody was really serious about it.
And we were good at it. That's the other thing. Mm-hmm. Like, the whole trick to making money selling appliances is don't damage them. Don't damage people's houses. You know, you got to do it carefully, dealing with it. And, you know, as a credit to our customers, like, people really do want to buy local. Like, mm-hmm. We have a really loyal community here in Prince Edward County of people who appreciate the businesses around them. So they did want to buy from us. And so as long as we could give them a fair price and good service, they, you know, we garnered local.
Service is key. And my analogy is there's no standing still. You're either moving forward or you're moving backwards. And you have to decide which hat you want to wear, right? In business, it's always good to be moving forward. And the opportunity was there, and we've done well at it. Yet to be seen what will happen in Wellington.
What's the future for Nash's Home Hardware?
We're in relatively uncertain economic times. So I've had a tough year this year, and I think that's echoed throughout the community. So if there was ever a time to buy local, get out there and support your local businesses. I think no matter what, when your plumbing breaks and you don't know how to fix it, you need to go to the hardware store and ask the guy how to, you know, the person there will help you figure out how to fix your leaky pipe or your broken toilet or whatever.
Yep. Great flush beats a full house every time.
It's amazing for 120 years that it's all in the same family.
I think the statistic was, you know, 70 or 80%, like it was quite a high number of businesses don't make it to that second generation, and over 90% don't make it to the third. So to make it to the fifth, like it's us and Hagerman's. Even if you look back at that 120 years, you've got two world wars, you've got pandemics, mm-hmm. you've got a Great Depression in there. You have to think it was a relatively desperate economic time, right? So people from that generation left. There was no opportunity for them here.
Yeah, it's crazy to think how you could possibly survive through all that. Depend on you, they trust you, and that's something you earn. You don't, it's not handed to you. We've been very, very lucky to be able to go where we've gone. I wouldn't say it's been fun all the time, but it's been a great time. It's nice when people depend on you and you can help them.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
And thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Thursday, July 17th, high of 27, feeling closer to 33 with the humidity. It's going to be a very humid and very warm day here in the city of Kingston. Friday, July 18th, we have a couple of showers in the forecast with the possibility of a thunderstorm that will cut down on some of the humidity, but it's still going to feel like 30 degrees here in the city of Kingston. Moving into the weekend, Saturday, July 19th, probably the nicest day of the week. It's going to be 26, but only feel like 28. Beautiful, sunny climate and conditions. Sunday, July 20th, we are expecting rain, a 73% chance of precipitation. Daytime high of 25, feeling like 26. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, July 21st, it'll be 26 degrees with plenty of beautiful sunshine. Here is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The LaSalle Causeway will be closed on Sunday, July 20th from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. Moving on to the road closures for the week, Aberdeen Street William II Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Abidon Road Highway 2 to Middle is closed until August 15th for the removal and replacement of a culvert. Albert Street Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Berry Street Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Bagot Street, Berry to West is closed July 16th at 7 a.m. to July 23rd at 7 p.m. to accommodate pedestrian and participant safety for the Canadian Little League Championship. Brock Street, Division II Palace is closed July 14th to 31st from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day for road resurfacing. Carlton Street, Alfred to Guy closed until August 8th for a gas main installation. Creighton Street at Chatham closed July 14th to 17th from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day to accommodate the removal of existing water and sanitary sewer services. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Guy Street, Carlton to Division is closed until August 8th for a gas main installation. King Street, Place d'Armes to Tragically Hip Way closed July 14th to 27th for Paw Patrol event-related parking and storage at Slush Puppy Place. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. And Wise Street, Woodbine to Megan is closed until July 31st to accommodate construction of a new sidewalk and road improvements. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Accommodation Road, 6th concession to White Church, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Abidon Road, Middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Catterockway Woods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic is down to one lane in each direction. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Garrett Road, 6th concession to Sandhill, expect delays while a contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Highway 2 to Abidon and St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users. Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road. And White Church Road, 6th concession to Woodburn, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.